Okay, well, thank you. Well, Jim, it's an enormous pleasure to be here. We first met at your 60th birthday party. I was just behind you getting into the auditorium, and the British hostess wouldn't let you in because you weren't wearing your name tag. And then there was a certain amount of confusion because you tried to convince her that you had to get in without revealing that you were the birthday boy, of course. And then I came here as a postdoc, but we didn't work together because you were writing your book. But then you retired, and things very much improved, and we started collaborating. I think we started collaborating in 2006 at the KITP program, which Gary organized on singularities. And I asked you offhand what you thought was really happening in the no boundary state at the initial singularity. And you said, well, let's see. And one question led to another, and here we are, more than 10 years later and a dozen papers later. Thanks very much for this wonderful, enriching collaboration, friendship for all those years. Life really doesn't get much better than figuring out the wave function together. So here you are, next to the founding father of quantum cosmology. This is a little statue in Louvain, in Belgium, of Georges Lemaître. And as Neil mentioned, Lemaître wrote that very first paper in 1931 connecting quantum theory and cosmology. He was a bit ahead of his time because it was another 50 years before your wave function paper appeared, which is, yeah, the basis of our collaboration, of course. And in fact, Stephen once told me, I'm not sure you can confirm this, that you guys had trouble getting this published, that the first referee told you that this was surely an outrageous use of Euclidean particles. And that the second referee said that the first referee was right, but that he thought the paper would be important, and so it should be published anyway. Here is Stephen on the genesis of your no boundary paper. This is an excerpt from Stephen's talk at your 60th birthday fest, which in the first sentence reveals what was driving you guys, the problem of initial conditions, clearly, and you were going to use Euclidean methods because, of course, Stephen's singularity theorems had shown that it was not going to work in the Lorentzian. And you and Stephen, as Gary described this morning, had already used Euclidean methods in the context of black hole particle creation. But this was a massive extension because it was not going to be used just for fluctuations, but for the background itself, a quantum treatment of the background itself. At the time, I gather Euclidean methods were somewhat of a Cambridge eccentricity, but now, of course, they live happily within holography and string theory. So then there's this other paragraph which describes how the whole project unfolded. And in fact, I was pleased to read that at least Stephen found it not obvious. He did find it obvious in 99, then apparently, but at least not in 83. Okay, so here it is in its original form. The key statement behind the no boundary wave function, in my view, is really, well, they made a choice to sum over compact Euclidean geometries instead of Euclidean geometries which are infinite. And that choice was entirely motivated by the fact that in cosmology, unlike in scattering experiments, we're interested in local observations within the system. So that's, I think, the key point about the no boundary wave function in my mind is that it deals with infinity. Of course, you guys were a little sloppy, eh? You didn't really say very much about the contour. A suitable contour is Hartle-Hawking language reflecting, what was it, lazy, no, Weyl's laziness. Yeah, so that's a little bit, that's a typical Hartle Hawking word. But soon, of course, I mean, the part integral motivation faded away, and you guys, or everyone else, really began to work with directly with the saddle points. And indeed, you conceptually, you can differentiate between the semi-classical saddle point wave function, which is a sum over saddle points, and its origin, as I'll explain a bit later. In most situations, there's a leading saddle point of the Euclidean path integral. That's what being calculated in 99% of the cases and being tested against observations. There are cases or models where there's a subleading saddle point, but if you're going to be adding saddle points, you better be careful that your wave function remains normalizable. And as far as I can see, a universal criterion for this to be the case is that fluctuations around your saddle points must be damped. Generally, these saddle points are complex. That's what's giving rise to these iconic pictures on your name tags. And gradually, make this transition from a Euclidean to a Lorentzian regime. Formally, the no-boundary wave function is a resolution of the initial singularity. Now, what actually happens is a different matter. Euclidean methods are notoriously vague about saying anything specific. But the first thing you could do is to study what kind of universes then emerge when the final geometry gets large. And that was a program which has pretty much been completed in many models. And there's sort of a four-line summary, which really sort of sums up that body of work. The first item is that classical cosmological evolution, according to the Lorentzian Einstein equations, emerges as a prediction from the wave function once the final geometry becomes large. And that's because the wave function starts to oscillate and the Wheeler-DeWitt equation to leading order predicts Einsteinian evolution. That process happens through an early period of inflation. So inflation in the no-boundary state pretty much is the Big Bang, is the origin of classical spacetime. Or put differently, classical spacetime emerges only through that process of inflation. Small inhomogeneous fluctuations around those saddle points are initially small and suppressed in their ground state as a consequence of the regularity condition on the saddle points. And that leads to at least a fluctuation arrow of time from which many other physical arrows of time follow, like the thermodynamic arrow of time or the psychological arrow of time and so forth. So this is Jim's favorite summary of those four lines. And yellow in Jim's slides means complex, right? So there we go. So let me, in the remainder of this talk, describe a few of the projects that Jim is now thinking about in the context of this wave function. Why didn't Jim just stop here when he retired? Well, this was just the beginning of getting a handle on the kind of reality that his wave function predicts. So the first set of questions on our mind is, well, all good and well, we have a wave function of the universe. How do we get from there to local predictions for our observations? And then the second item I'd like to touch on briefly is a new formulation of the no-boundary wave function, which, if you haven't heard about, will surprise you, I think. So let's discuss a few of the predictions for observations. Okay, so we have a wave function. It describes, It's a function of the final geometry, so it forcefully describes an ensemble of possible universes. But we're interested in predicting future observations or current observations of local observables in our quasi-classical realm. So given some observational situation characterized by some data deep within the universe. So somehow we are interested in conditional probabilities conditioned on that local observation, which includes a quasi-classical realm. And forcefully, they're going to be extremely, extremely coarse-grained. And in fact, I think it's only at that level that we really need probabilities to emerge. So maybe this is, in fact, pretty much in line with what Mark was getting at. Now, our observational situation acts, when you sort of reconstruct the history, as a kind of final condition, right? It's a set of data from which you are able, which specifies a quasi-classical realm, and from which you are able to sort of carve out a subset of a highly coarse-grained past histories. Jim likes to say, well, this is coarse-graining. This is a particular coarse-grained history. Stephen liked to call this a top-down probability because it's sort of you start from an observational situation and, in a sense, reconstruct the history. And to me, it makes me think of Wheeler's eye, which is a reasonable implementation of Wheeler's vision in that respect. In any case, when it comes to testing the theory of the wave function of the universe or deriving predictions or whatever, doing something with it which we can falsify, the conditioning on D is not a choice. It's just a fact. We are interested, or we are able to test correlations between our observational situation, launching the Planck satellite, and features of the universe. Now, for the four items that I mentioned before, classical cosmology, inflation, fluctuations, and the arrow of time, the condition of D on D, or observational situation, doesn't matter very much. But it does matter for some other predictions which are important. And that has everything to do with the relative weighting that the no-boundary wave function assigns to different inflationary histories. The no-boundary wave function comes with an enhancement of the backgrounds, which favors a low amount of inflation and a suppression of the fluctuations, which predicts Gaussian fluctuations. But if you condition on D, you're going to shift that probability distribution and get it peaked around histories with a long period of inflation. So that's an important effect. Note that this is a quantum mechanically, respectfully way of introducing entropic reasoning, right? D does not need to be entropic, but if it is entropic, then this basically implements a kind of entropic reasoning without ever adding an entropic principle to the theoretical framework. So now let me just illustrate this in an extremely simple model, but it sort of illustrates the use of doing cosmology with a wave function. So imagine the following model of inflation. You roll down to some minimum, and you can do so from two sides. And imagine that all our data, our observational situation at the present time, agrees with both sets of histories. But now we're about to measure the tilt and the tensor to scalar ratio of the CMB spectrum. And imagine the tilt and the tensor to scalar ratio of the CMB spectrum are different, depending whether you roll down from the left or the right. So then we're interested in that kind of probability that I sketched just earlier. That probability is calculated from the wave function using the saddle point approximation of by assigning a saddle point to this side and to another side. Now, those saddle points each will have their own weight. You square the saddle point wave function squared, assuming Born's rule, and you get a relative weighting in the no boundary state for rolling down from the left or the right. And that's the kind of weighting which we use or which we interpret as a betting instruction for observing the tensor to scalar ratio associated with the blue universes or with the red universes. So we think of it as a kind of completion of cosmology, which provides us with a theoretical prior, which, by the way, is more sharply peaked than a kind of prior based on ignorance, which is the standard prior used when you do cosmological observations, right? These contours of the Planck measurements, of course, are what we learn about cosmology purely from observation. They're using a flat prior. If you were to draw the same contours based on your no-boundary wave function prior, it would look very different. It would look very peaked. Now, one of the more challenging applications along these lines is when it comes to eternal inflation. So let's return to the same model. And this is really where Jim's and Murray's machinery seriously comes into play. So now imagine the same model, but imagine that high up at this potential on both sides, you enter a regime of eternal inflation. That means that above some threshold, the field doesn't really roll down, but the quantum fluctuations dominate the dynamics, and any notion of classical roll down, classical background disappears. When we are calculating probabilities, then we must coarse grain once we enter that regime of eternal inflation, because those fluctuations basically mean that the wave function is going to spread out like hell. And as you know, from a particle in one dimension, in a line, if you want to locate it, and if the wave function is spread out, it's impossible, because the histories that you're after are too fine-grained to decohere. So this leads to quite a different viewpoint on eternal inflation. Let me illustrate it. There's D, our data. We use that classical realm to reconstruct a history or a set of past histories. And it's, of course, very tempting. And so the boundary of this red thing is sort of the threshold of eternal inflation. It's very tempting to go beyond and to sort of envision a larger universe with different patches where eternal inflation has ended, some of them from the blue side, others from the red side, and so forth. But what you're doing there is extending your classical realm way, way too far. In fact, this is but one particular branch of the wave function, and the wave function is spread out over a whole range of different universes which don't decohere, which are far too fine-grained. So the instruction, or what follows from these kind of probabilities, so it's similar here, right, if you were to do this. So what we are proposing is that you should stop at the threshold of eternal inflation. And here comes Murray's and Jim's framework, and you coarse grain over everything outside. You just don't go there. You take a maximally coarse grained picture of the universe in line with the fact that there's no decoherence beyond the threshold of eternal inflation. So I'm not saying that this is some sort of the sitter space, I'm saying that this is maximal ignorance. Again, the no boundary wave function deals, in my view, with infinity. And this is the way he does it. But this, we know how to calculate. The amplitude for the conditional amplitude on D for a red kind of classical realm to emerge is exactly given by the no-boundary saddle point with the scalar field at the threshold for return inflation here on this side. And we have another amplitude for a blue patch, a blue classical realm to emerge from that regime of return inflation given by a different saddle point, also conditioned on D with that threshold. And so just as before, even in models of eternal inflation, psi supplies a theoretical prior, which you could use to predict or to bet on future Planck observations. So now, So now let me tell you about Jim's favorite prediction in this context. Many of you will recognize it, I think. And if not, yeah, it will be a little brief. But this is the prediction in sort of a mini landscape of the cosmological constant. So many of you will know Weinberg's old entropic prediction of lambda, in which you... This is a refinement of this. So the story of Weinberg's old prediction is that, well, it came out really well. So this is the amplitude of the initial fluctuations, the CMB fluctuations, and this is lambda. And Weinberg's old prediction was that, well, lambda comes out perfectly right, assuming the 10 to the minus 5, assuming the observed amplitude for the initial CMB fluctuations. But then various people pointed out that, wait a minute, once you enlarge in your scope of possible universes, this is not going to go so well. Once you let the initial amplitude vary as well, Weinberg's prediction is several orders of magnitude off. So what you should have in mind here is a kind of mini landscape of models of inflation where you have a cosmological constant and a scalar field with some mass which then sets the amplitude of the initial fluctuations, right? Now, we couldn't resist calculating the same kind of probability which we were doing before, but with the no boundary prior, and we were delighted to see that Weinberg's predict that the no boundary prior pushes you down again and restored Weinberg's successful entropic prediction. And Jim has been happy ever since.
Sorry, did the entropic criterion come into the location of that red star?
Oh, yeah, this was Weinberg's,
So we didn't know that we were here, would Cy Hartle Hawking predict much smaller fluctuation?
That's right, so but the entropic constraint in our framework comes in by requiring D, right? Yeah, sure.
Isn't this model now because of the tensor?
Yes, you mean that model? Sure, yes. So you could have it, you would have to generalize.
You have to replace that,
okay. Yes, that's right, yeah. Okay, good. So, now let me conclude. This is sort of different from what we've been hearing today, but I think it's important to mention some new developments on the no-boundary wave function, which came about from studies of holography. So as I mentioned, the original part integral motivation sort of faded away, and in fact, it was replaced by another part integral, which has everything to do with the developments in holography. So this is another Santa Barbara paper. In fact, I think the first time I heard, to my knowledge, that I saw the Euclidean version of ADS-CFT being stated as a statement about a wave function of the universe was in this paper by Gary and Juan. So what Gary and Juan were doing was, well, they were considering negative universes with negative cosmological constant, in which you have these geometries, and then some metric H tilde on the conformal boundary there. And Euclidean action gives you a kind of wave function, which take this form. It's this exponential factor of just a local function of the boundary data, and an amplitude which remains finite if you take the boundary out. And the Euclidean version of ADS-CFT is the conjecture that that amplitude can be calculated by a partition function which is directly defined on the boundary of your Euclidean approximately ADS spaces. That's the essence of the Euclidean version of ADS-CFT. This is a partition function of a field theory on a deformed sphere or so, which is of course itself a path integral, but it's a very different path integral. For one, it doesn't include gravity. This is an important statement because in this form, it's very clear that ADS-CFT suggests or supports the idea of a unique wave function of the universe. There is nothing to vary here. The data that are needed to determine the partition function of the CFT are the same as the data that the wave function depends on in the large volume limit. And you can add matter fields and so forth. Of course, this is all for negative cosmological constant. But here comes the trick. Jim realized that we can generalize this. And in fact, Gary and Juan, in their paper, suggest or conjecture it should also hold for more generally for Lorentzian universes, right? And in fact, it's very easy to see that something like that might work. This is the saddle point form on your name tag, but in fact, it's old fashioned. This is the new one. These saddle points are complex solutions, regular at the bottom, real boundary data, but there are various different geometric representations of the same complex geometry. And we showed that all no boundary saddle points, no matter what the final data are, do in fact have a geometric representation in which the Euclidean part of the geometry is Euclidean deformed ADS space, so getting very large. And then there's a complex transition to get real final data on the final boundary. But much more importantly, so there's a kind of a natural connection at the level of the wave function, at the level of the saddle points, between Euclidean ADS and Lorentzian de Sitter. But much more importantly, imagine Jim and Steven had done it that way in their original paper, then they would have calculated the wave function using that geometric representation of the saddle point, and then they would have gotten the following form. Their wave function, it would have been immediately obvious, is a big phase factor, which is entirely local, a function of the boundary data, and an amplitude, which is entirely given by the Euclidean ADS part of the saddle point. Now, since holography came along, we would know how to deal with this wave function. We would replace the amplitude by a partition function. Now, if you go through the math, you find that in this case, the amplitude is not given by the partition function of the original, otherwise you would get a Euclidean theory. It's the inverse of the partition function of the ADS dual field theory that enters here. I'm not saying we have a full-blown DS-CFT realization for the experts here. This is just a saddle point construction. I'm just playing around with saddle points. I am saying that at the semi-classical level, we have realizations of DS-CFT straight flowing out from the Euclidean version of ADS-CFT. Now, of course, this looks very different. we now have the no boundary wave function living on the boundary, and so it clearly has a boundary now. But I thought I would mention it because in the last couple of years, this really has led to an enormous revival of the no boundary proposal. In fact, there are many more papers calculating the Hartle-Hawking wave function in holography these days than there are in traditional quantum cosmology. Now, a caveat, if you do that saddle point construction and you add fields and you look at this, you're gonna not land with the typical field theory that you use in ADS-CFT. You're going to, it's only in very special cases, very simplified cases, where, because generally the sources, when you add fields, the sources in the field theory become complex. So it's in only in very simplified cases where you really can get your hands dirty and calculate those partition functions. So far, the impact on quantum cosmology of these developments has been limited, but it provides an interesting new twist on the no boundary wave function. And especially, it invites us to import many of the techniques that have been developed in the context of ADS-CFT into quantum cosmology. And so I think that's a fruitful future line of research, which ultimately I think will reshape our picture of the no boundary wave function altogether. The key point, of course, behind the no boundary wave function survives. The no boundary proposal originally is about the emergence of time. And here as well, it's the time dimension which emerges from the Euclidean dual field theory. In a sense, it's also a further unification between the dynamics and the state, although, of course, the price you pay is that every dynamics has to emerge from the correspondency. An important question to me, ultimately, is whether that line or that formulation of the no boundary wave function can shed some light on that crucial feature. So this is very, very roughly the form of the traditional Euclidean saddle point associated with the Hartle-Hawking wave function. The backgrounds featuring are enhanced, where this is 1 over the potential evaluated pretty much at the south pole. The fluctuations are suppressed. And so this is a very delicate affair, because this is really what you need and what we observe. This means that the condition on the quasi-classical realm is absolutely crucial to get the Hartle-Hawking wave function in line with our observations, because this favors very low inflation, and you compensate it by conditioning on our quasi-classical realm. If you don't do it, the predictions just don't match. And so either this is a serious failure of the theory, suggesting that quantum gravity is going to do something very different, or it points indeed towards a deep connection between the condition on our quasi-classical realm and the predictions of the theory. Okay, I should probably... Well, okay, so to conclude, I think Jim's universal wave function is alive and well. The mathematical underpinnings have changed, but the key physics idea of bringing quantum theory and cosmology together is proving fruitful ground for research. I think your wave function is still new, Jim.
Okay, questions?
So, in your discussion of eternal inflation, you didn't mention the zero graphic distribution. Could you comment on whether that's in there somewhere or not?
Yes, it is not. Because we start from a given observation situation.
So
we're looking at different histories leading up to a given and we're not moving us around in a single history.
So do you feel that's a superior approach to deploying a zero-graphic distribution, or is it just an alternative view, or how are you contrasting these different approaches?
Yeah, so I think it's better, because I think the other approach, by extending a sort of eternally inflating universe, and I just think it's far too much of an extension of our classical reality. So I think, in fact, we're forced to coarse grain. That's my main message when it comes to eternal inflation.
Thanks.
Another question?
So do you have a principle for deciding how much of the present data you use to condition? I mean, presumably, if you condition on me sitting here asking this question, you're going to slice out an incredibly tiny piece of the wave function, which presumably is not relevant for what the B modes in the CMB are going to be. But how do you decide what pieces to use in conditioning?
In practice, it is calculational simplicity, of course. You have to be able to, you condition on a kind of distribution of galaxies or whatever, or CMB observations to some extent. But there's no principle.
But don't you get different answers
the viewpoint,
then?
Sorry?
Don't you get different answers depending on what you choose for D?
No. In the beginning, yes, but once your D is sufficiently detailed, the whole thing asymptotes to fixed.
Any other questions, right? Yep, me again. So for the wave function to collapse, to particular state, you need the external interaction. Is there any discussion on external interaction, like a measurement for the this whole universe wave function collapse?
No, there's nothing external. And it's not collapsing as far as I can see. We're just interested in a particular set of coarse grain probabilities derived from the wave function. Sorry?
The universe happened, yeah? So what about this fact of happening, which was discussed in a previous talk?
Well, no, measurement I don't think is fundamental. We start with data characterizing our observation situation, and we're calculating probabilities for future observations. And all the ingredients in the decoherent histories formulation, together with the wave function of the universe, are sufficient to perform that task.
So what is the probability for this universe to happen?
Probably very low.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe it's related with Steve. I didn't quite understand your point that you said that conditioning on D is not a choice, it's a fact. But why couldn't you just make that the null set and just calculate the absolute probability of all of your observations? Just make D as essentially, don't condition at all, just calculate the probability of some set of observations.
Sure, you could do that.
Okay.
Yeah, you could do that, but you would not be testing your theory.
Then you would avoid this ambiguity that Steve brought up, that it's going to depend on what you condition on. And so to avoid that, just don't condition on anything.
So in all calculations that we've done,
yeah, because you could compare different theories. It would be like the likelihood of the theory. And then if you had alternative theory, you could calculate the likelihoods of alternative theories. And then, of course, you have to weigh them by the...
You just said that in that case, you get very little inflation, and therefore there's
no
inflation. Sure. Right, but if it's consistent with our observations to have very, very low inflation, then
no,
that
sounds
somewhat bad.
No, because you've used the word our observations. Our observations mean a condition... And
no, but why? I thought what I would think we would like the theory to predict probabilities for our observations, not have to put in our observations first. I mean, in other words, we want to have a likelihood of the theory, and the likelihood of the theory is the probability of our observations given the theory. So why can't we just calculate those directly without putting in some extra conditions?
We don't like the answer.
It's a fact that we have a certain observation situation. I'm saying it's important to put it in, and that's the realistic situation. You might find it more pleasing that the theory predicts our observation situation in its entirety. And maybe I would find that more pleasing too, but it's certainly not a necessity. Parts of our universe could be the result of quantum accidents, and then you're never going to predict these with a high probability. So we have to be open to both possibilities. This is the way the no boundary wave function works.
One more question?
But it does converge in the sense of your question. Putting in more details about our observation situation, in all models that I've worked out, zoom in on definite predictions. It does not keep on depending on adding more D.
Okay, time for one more.
So let's say you were to use as your conditional observations, not the whole universe as we see it now, but only some neighborhood of our galaxy. Could you say just using that to condition your wave function, would you have any prediction about what the rest of the universe should look like?
The answer is yes. That's
how likely is it that it should look essentially the same, or could it be quite different?
Sure, that's what in our papers. Yeah. You condition on a fraction of our observational data here on Earth, and you get the rest of the universe out. That's the essence of our papers.
Okay, I think we're eating into the drinks time now. So thank you, Tom, for that talk. Before we go, I think Gary wants to say a few words, but I'd also like to just take the opportunity to say thank you to Gary and everyone in Santa Barbara for organizing this wonderful meeting.
Yeah, and Tom.
Thank you. So first of all, I want to thank all the speakers for their excellent talks, for making this just a wonderful day. And finally, Jim has a daughter who unfortunately was not able to come, but sent a short video. So Thomas, you want to turn it on? So we can't show it outside, so let's show it now, and then we'll go for drinks.